Hello and welcome to the Hall of Fame Video Game Podcast, starring Matt Levy and Mike Staub. We love video games and have embarked on a journey to index the greatest video games of all time into our very own Hall of Fame. Here's the show. Hello, guys. Welcome back to a remastered episode. I am Matt, and hey, Mike, how are you?
Good. I'm Mike. I'm here again to talk about a game we've already talked about, but we've been hinting at doing this for quite some time because at the beginning of the show, we did a lot of two-game episodes.
We made some silly choices, Mike, that our past selves, they just didn't know better. We can't judge them.
No, we can't. We can't. Now we've learned that we need to give certain games, well, most games we talk about, all games we talk about, we need to give them the full one game per episode.
Yeah, so, there were about a dozen or so games. I don't have an exact count. Yeah. That we crammed together, Mike, and we talked about some epic, legendary, some of the best games ever made.
Yes.
For like 20 minutes, and that just doesn't cut it.
No, it really doesn't. And this one, Ocarina of Time, was a game that we did on the same episode as Castlevania Symphony of the Night, and that is both kind of disrespectful to both games. So I think it's good that we're starting our remaster series with this.
Totally. And I think it's a little apropos because we're going to be hitting the 25th anniversary of this game in the next couple months.
Yeah, November, right? It would be November of 1998. This game released right before Thanksgiving. I got that game. I got this game for Christmas that year. It was one of those things that I just couldn't sit still until I had it, to the point where like my parents let me open it on Christmas Eve because I needed it now. I needed it in my veins.
I don't know if this is like around 6th, 7th, 8th grade, Mike and Matt. I know it's middle school.
7th grade. I was in 7th grade.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And middle school, I remember, and I spoke about this last time, but my buddy had it before I did. I had Mario 64. I had Mario Kart, but I did not have The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. And he said, "Did you play the newest Zelda?" And I don't know. I thought he was talking about Link's Awakening Link to the Past. But at that time, he said, no, there's a Zelda 64, Mike.
Yeah, it's a big deal. It was a big deal then. It's a big deal now. This is one of those games that people still say is the best game ever made. I don't necessarily agree with those people anymore, but it's definitely one that deserves that.
Things get approved upon. And that's not a slight at Ocarina have done things better than it. But its impact, what it did at that time, was really astonishing. And again, there was so much that we couldn't talk about. So we thought, let's talk about this game all over again.
Sure.
Let's get into what makes this game truly amazing. So do you remember even appreciating 12-year-old you, what some of the things did that this game was special, even at that time?
Yeah, I think the thing that impressed me most about this game when it came out was the scale, right? Zelda had never looked like this. Zelda had never played like this. While the formula was the same as Link to the Past in terms of you do three dungeons and you get a thing, and then you do six dungeons and then you go fight Ganon. Even the time jump, which is remarkable and original and very fun, even that is really not that dissimilar to the light and dark world of the Link to the Past.
Sure.
But I think when you look at it, the jump to 3D was huge. Figuring out how 3D combat could work in a 3D action game was a huge, huge deal. Zelda isn't the first game to feature targeting, but it's among the first games to feature some sort of targeting. So that was necessary, right?
Yeah, you could. I know you've talked about how Mega Man might have been the first.
It was. Mega Man Legends beat this game by a year. So,
but what this game does is it gives you a one-to-one combat, not just targeting. It defines one-to-one action where you can sidestep, backflip, and attack all while zoning in on one character. And that's something that Mega Man didn't do.
Mega Man Legends didn't do that, but you can absolutely target and it will zoom. But I don't think Zelda, like, quote unquote, ripped it off either. But these games were in development at the same time. I think both games knew that in order for 3D combat to work in an action game, you needed some degree of targeting, because this game also got delayed a year.
Yeah.
It was supposed to come out a year earlier, and Mega Man Legends obviously releases a year earlier in Japan. So they're pretty much contemporaries of each other. They're actually very similar, a little bit more similar than people would realize.
And that's one of the many, many firsts. It was one of the first major delays, one of the first major, like, hyped and pre-ordered games. This game, we're going to talk about so many firsts it did, but you're right. This was delayed. It's commonplace now, but that didn't happen back in 1998. I mean, games either released in whatever condition they were, or they came out when they were supposed to. But this is when production and cinema and things were influenced video games.
Absolutely. I mean, the first real release dates that people really can remember back to are like Mortal Monday and the Sonic 2 Tuesday.
Sure.
But other than that, video games kind of just got released when they got released.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like a thing where, like, we knew for months and months and months that there was a release date and we were building up to it. And Ocarina of Time was a game that did that. It was one of the first games I remember when you pre-ordered, you got a different version of the game. You got the gold cartridge if you pre-ordered it. So
it's so cool, Mike. I mean, just talking about the gold cartridge, I mean, this is not something that happens really very often. I mean, you can think of some series in N64, Super Nintendo, and even the original NES, where they'd release sometimes, I think there were green cartridges for N64. I believe that was Donkey Kong.
Donkey Kong 64, I believe, was yellow.
Yellow, thank you.
I think Turok was green.
That's maybe what it
was. Might have been red. There might have been a red Turok as well. When you have a plastic cartridge, you can have fun with it, and you can release different colors for the games. Like, some of the cartridges were black for some of the games, but, like, for the most part, they were gray. But when Zelda came out in 98 with a gold cartridge, that was one of, like, the first times I remember seeing a gold cartridge video game. I feel like there was an Army Men that was probably green.
I got a list for you here. So 007 World Is Not Enough came in blue. Mm-hmm. But it had a gray variant. A game I never heard of, Aiden Chronicles, came in black, also had a gray variant.
Yes.
All-Star Baseball had a red.
Yeah.
Army Men, you're correct, had a green, both Army Men games. Batman Beyond Return of the Joker came in black.
Okay.
So there were definitely a lot. Donkey Kong, you had it yellow. Earthworm Jim 3D came out in yellow.
Yellow.
But Majora's Mask and Ocarina of Time were the only ones to have that gold. Actually, Pokemon Stadium 2, strangely enough, had a gold release.
Gold and silver. I think the cartridge was like gold on the front and silver on the back.
Spider-Man 64 had a red.
Red, yeah.
Tony Hawk Pro Skater 2 had a blue for the original, two for the sequel. Yeah. So it is not crazy. It's not like out of the norm, but it's still pretty special, Mike.
Nobody's releasing gold. And Majora's Mask, both versions were gold, and one of them had a holographic label. So that was so cool. You had to get the gold cartridge. I got Ocarina of Time, the gold cartridge with a gold controller. So it was like one of those things where it was such a monumental moment for video games. And it was like the first time I was really, really aware of video games having a very special release. Because when you go back and you think about it, like, we were 12 at the time. So this game coming out, like, having to wait the month for Christmas was a nightmare for me. Like, I knew it was in my house. Like, and it was one of those things. It was like, that's what Christmas became about. Like, it was no longer the mystery of it all. It was having to wait and the fear of, if you did something bad, maybe it would get returned. But I opened this game and I was blown away immediately by the scale. The intro kind of movie where Navi, the fairy that we would kind of all grow to kind of
despise.
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I know people that still have the Hey Listen as their
And it's a wonderful nod to Tinkerbell. And it's like this wonderful memory we have of the game looking back on it. But it was annoying at the time.
It's still annoying, even though you can look back at it with nostalgia. But yeah, no, Link, like you said, Link is totally a Peter Pan kind of homage down to the fairy that follows him. But when Navi the fairy finds Link in the Kokori village, and everything kind of leading up to the Great Deku Tree or the Great Deku Tree, like, nothing felt like that ever.
No.
Mario 64 was like the first monumental watershed moment in video gaming that I remember. that like felt so different and so original and was like just mouth droppingly incredible. Like I remember that was another game I got for Christmas with my N64 and just kind of being blown away by how everything had changed just by putting something in the third degree. Now when you do that to Zelda, it's like there were two more years to kind of work on how the 3D game could operate. And from it was just such a, for lack of a better word, it's such a cinematic experience, something that felt so different. And even though A Link to the Past tries its best to be as cinematic as it can be, given the restrictions that it had in the 16 bits, playing a game like Ocarina of Time and just feeling like you're walking into something that is of the biggest of scale, it feels like you're a very small piece of this world, and everything that you do in this game just feels like you're kind of against all odds because the sheer scale and size of everything, the bosses are enormous.
Yeah.
You're introduced to the bosses by the game giving you their name on the screen. Like that's the first time Zelda would do that. It would do that in every game after this, when you first fight Goma, right? And it's just like Goma, and it gives you like Goma, and it tells you like, kind of like it's Goma has a subtitle, right? They all have like these subtitles that explain to you what they are. It's like spider monster Goma or whatever. And the ability to give you this larger world to play in and give you all these tools as Link to solve puzzles and interact with your environment, like nothing felt like that. Like burning a Deku stick so that you can burn a spider web is like one of the first things you do with the game. And it's something that makes so much sense, but it's not something games had ever done at that point.
It almost seems like a Breath of the Wild type thing there, taking a torch, lighting it, and seeing how that affects the world.
Yeah.
But I love how you talk so poetically, Mike, about the scale. And the things that I see when I first played this game was the obviously Link to the Past, one of my favorite games, but there were 16-bit limitations. And this game being on N64, it kind of skipped a generation. Nintendo kind of skipped the 32-bit era, and it paid some dividends, but it also took them a little long to get there, and it's where the PS1 took a lot of market share. But games like Resident Evil and games like Final Fantasy VII were very successful on the PS1, but things that this game did better is that those games are basically on paintings. They're on backdrops. Yeah. They're on really pretty, gorgeous backdrops, and then the 3D models are walking around it. This game is actually in a full 3D space, and that's something the PS1 couldn't do, and that blew me away at the time, because I was playing PS1 games, and then I'd play Mario 64 or Zelda 64, and I was just blown away. I've now grown to respect and appreciate all that they did on the PS1 with it being a 32-bit console, but I look at games like Zelda and said, wow, they don't need cutscenes to pull the weight graphically. The in-game had that scale. You said it, the complexity of the world, where Mario 64 was limited, Mike. You're walking around this spectacular castle, but you're jumping from each painting to load another world. And that's something that me now, understanding game mechanics, figure, well, that's a limitation. Back at the time, I thought it was magical jumping into another world. But now I see Zelda, where every trail leads to the next area. It feels like one open world, like games are today.
Yeah, it's definitely one contiguous kind of environment. Hyrule Field with your hub, and then you kind of can go anywhere you want. Because you're not limited by CD technology, you don't have to worry about loading. And it's seamless, right? You can walk from, I mean, to get the Bigoron sword, right? You pretty much have to go from all the way from one side of the map to the other. And there are definitely spots where the game kind of loads, like when you go through the Lost Woods or you do things like that, where like the environment changes and stuff like that. But for the most part, it's pretty seamless. And it's incredible. Like,
yeah,
there's
that is
nothing
the advantage
like
of a 32 megabyte cartridge. You know, that's helping them when it comes to those type of things.
Yeah. And it's obviously utilized to just incredible results in Ocarina of Time. I mean, nothing really looked like this. At the time, you bring up a great point where Final Fantasy VII and Resident Evil, they're essentially on bitmap images.
Yeah.
And that was done for Resident Evil to kind of respond to the limitations. They couldn't do over the shoulder or behind the character kind of graphics because it just didn't work.
But I think it was effective. I mean, not to go off the tangent. As a kid, I didn't know better. When I played Final Fantasy VII and VIII, I thought I was walking in a 3D world. I had no idea that, and I learned as an adult, okay, I'm just walking upstairs, but it's not really stairs. I'm not really walking on a 3D model of stairs.
Well, to be fair, too, those bitmap images that are behind the player in those games, like Resident Evil is a great example, because you don't have to worry about 3D graphics and generating the stuff in different viewpoints of the room, you could really, really design them. Like, they can be really detailed.
Very tight, too.
And that's always the comparison between something like Resident Evil 4 and the original Resident Evil remake. When you look at it, you go, oh, I get it. I get why there are some parts of this game that look better in the remake, because you could just really over design the each individual image that you're walking on. But Zelda needed to kind of have that open world feel.
Yeah.
And to do that, to do it right. And that's every Zelda game ever, right? Every Zelda game ever is kind of a small open world, no matter how linear or how open it is. It's a small open world, and you could go wherever the heck you want. So that was an important part of Zelda. Ocarina of Time allowed you to do it in a more realized 3D space. And nothing really felt like that. And nothing felt like that after Ocarina of Time for quite some time. I mean, yes, obviously Majora's Mask, but we wouldn't get a game that would feel like that again until Wind Waker, right?
Yeah.
And even Wind Waker has some loading, right?
Yeah, no, it's pretty spectacular. I want to pinpoint one topic, and I have many things we want to get to. One being, you talked about the Biggeron sword, and that's a side quest. Yeah. Side quests are a commonplace thing in video games these days, but video games didn't have side quests, Mike. They had the quest. There wasn't like other things to do, and this game had the Scarecrow. It had Pose. It had horse races and Epona. It had the Skulletas, which just went forever. The Biggeron sword was, like you said, a really long side quest, but they paid off and they were fun and they felt like they were part of. They didn't feel like it was a detachment. It felt like it was things Link should be doing in this world.
Yeah, and you actually kind of need the Biggeron sword to fight Ganon at the end of the game, because he takes away the Master Sword before he becomes, I guess, Ganon, Pig Ganon, when you're fighting Ganondorf.
You love a good Pig Ganon, don't you?
He's the best. Pig Ganon's the best version of Ganon. I think he should always be a pig. But if you don't have the Biggeron Sword, you can use the Megaton Hammer. But yeah, you kind of need the Biggeron Sword, and it's like a multi-level side quest. You get the Giant's Knife, you break it, and then you have to go find Biggeron, who lives like in the mountain as the mountain, and you have to find him, you have to get him eye drops and all this stuff. So, and then you got to wait 3 days, and it's an incredible thing. Side quests at this point in time were not really something that mainstream adventure games did. It was much more of a JRPG thing.
Yeah.
RPGs did side quests. Final Fantasy did side quests. And that was pretty much it.
And an action adventure game, which we've talked about in the past, this game does have role-playing elements to it, but in an action adventure game, which is what this is, you had a quest, you had a linear quest. Generally,
usually you were just going A to Z, right? And there were no primes, so you were kind of just going along the line. And Zelda even was kind of like that, but there are side quests in this series, and I feel like this is the first time. Now, this is not the first time there were side quests in Zelda games, but this is the first time where the side quests in a Zelda game were much more important and much more prominent and much more plentiful. There were a lot of them. It wasn't just like, hey, you swim under the bridge and you talk to the guy and get a bottle. Right. It's not like that. These were like multi-leveled side quests where you would have to go find however many Skulltellas there were, or you'd have to get the big sword or get all the magic. There's a whole bunch of like the three spells you get in this game, you know, you can kind of miss them.
And you meet elaborate NPCs along the way. I mean, there's some narrative behind each of these side quests as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, getting all the hearts, getting all the heart pieces, right? That's a huge deal. And that totally changes the game. So no, there's absolutely. so much that this game has packed in that you could just totally miss. You could forget to plant beans. You can not get the Scatullas. You cannot get the heart pieces.
Some of the games you play in the towns where you win those contests. I mean, that stuff, you can just ignore all of that. And there's some worthwhile stuff in there. And that's very, again, commonplace in games with towns and Zelda games. But again, these were more original things back in 1988.
Oh, yeah. They were much more original, much more novel. I mean, having a day-night cycle in general.
It's absurd for 1998.
It's totally different. It's not something we would see a lot. And not only did you have a day-night cycle, like I remember the first time running towards like the Hyrule Castle town and it turns to night by the time you get there. And then the Stalfos climb out of the ground and you have to fight skeletons because it's nighttime and it's dangerous to be out in the fields at night. Or when you're running towards the Hyrule Castle at the end of the first segment of the game and Zelda rides past you on Epona. And as you get to Hyrule Castle, it gets progressively darker, becomes nighttime by the time you get there, regardless of what happens. And Zelda rides past you. She throws the ocarina into the water. Ganon rides past you. He kind of knocks you down when his horse like rears. Then you go and you get the ocarina and you play the Song of Time or whatever. And then eventually you go to the temple, you get trapped in time.
Yeah, no, the changing of time is one thing, but like you said, I mean, changing a day, it's a night, but the changing of time is another just incredible thing here. It's kind of sad. It's kind of dark when you go from this happy, amazing, wonderful world as a kid, as Child Link, and then the first time you see the world in the future and how everything is just despair and this whole different setting and the enemies that are creepy as anything, and you're this now adult, you're this full-grown Link, and like you said, there's things that affect the world before and after. Mm-hmm. And that time travel element, you don't have that in video games today.
No.
You go to two worlds and see things different. And here we are seeing that.
And it's crazy how the things you do as a kid can affect the future, right? Whether it's playing the Song of Storms for that guy that messes up the windmill, or the one dungeon, I believe it's the Spirit Temple, that you have to start it as a kid and then finish it as an adult. Which I think is really cool. The fact that there are items you get as a kid that you can't use as an adult, or if you buy beans as a child and plant them, they will grow as an adult and then you can get cool items by like riding these leaves around.
I mean, these are complex ideas and complex mechanics that you just really didn't find in video games.
Yeah. If you're going to have a time travel element, at least use it. Right. Don't just use it as like an excuse to as a plot point, right? As something to kind of tell more of the story and to just be like, oh yeah, everything got bad when you were asleep. Link should stop going to bed. I think that's probably the best idea. Nothing good happens when Link goes to sleep.
No, he just needs to get some insomnia going for him.
Yeah.
One thing you mentioned, and I think this is monumental. I think this is like where we probably should start, middle. Finish. This should just be the whole conversation. Is you said he's got an ocarina. It's in the title. This game has so much music in it. Mike, what does the ocarina, what does the music mean to video gaming at large, Zelda at large? What is the music and the ocarina in this game? What does it mean?
Well, I feel like this is the first time where music became an important part of Zelda. He has a flute in Link to the Past. I believe they call it flute in America, but I think it's actually an ocarina. I think if you play the Game Boy version, I think they call it an ocarina, but I might be wrong. But this is the first time where like you learn songs and you have, when you take out the ocarina, staff comes up, and by using the buttons on the controller and the analog stick, you can actually play and control the pitches. So not only is this a way to do things in the game where you learn a series of songs and you have to use them at certain points to prove Link's validity, right, as his connection to Zelda, or change the day to night or the night to day, make a storm come in, fast travel. Like these are all sorts of things that the ocarina can do. And it's so important to this game and the other games that follow it that it's really just an amazing addition. because not only is Zelda just an adventure game, but it's also a game that has a very important, deep musical element to it. And you could sit with the ocarina for hours and just mess with it to try to play songs that you know. And I think that's really cool. As someone who has always been a musician, that part of the game I thought was such a weird and interesting and amazing add-on that made the game even more unique to have this element. And like, you would go to see that in Majora's Mask. We would see it in Wind Waker. We would see it a little bit in Twilight Princess, and just how important music had become to the Zelda franchise as a whole.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. You can go back to the original Nintendo NES Zelda, and obviously you have the great Overworld song, which is the Zelda theme that we know today. And then, of course, Link to the Past has some wonderful tunes in it, but music never feels like it's an integral part of what we know of Zelda at that time. This is where really it became associated with Zelda. We expect a new Zelda game. We expect amazing orchestra playing music and musical beats and maybe an instrument. And that's Zelda now. That's what we expect Zelda to be. And this game had so many hits, whether it's stuff you play on the ocarina or just tunes in the actual game.
Yeah.
No matter where you are, if you're at Lon Lon Ranch, if you're at Gerudo Valley, one of my favorites, if you're playing Song of Storms, I mean, these are classic tunes that you can play on a piano, a guitar, and just think you're listening to something classically beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, Koji Kondo like really just did incredible work.
Yeah.
And some of these songs had appeared in Zelda before. The music from Kakariko Village is from Link to the Past. Zelda's Lullaby is from Link to the Past.
Yep.
But they're fully realized, right, in this game. And the music means something. Like when you're trying to make your way through the Lost Woods, you have to listen to the music in order to find your way to Saria. And I've never seen a video game do that before.
No. No, like, it's almost like the music is part of the world building. Like it's almost part of the environments. And when you reach the Gorons, the Gerudos, the Zoras, who they're all introduced here for the first time. So that's like epic world building. But putting a music and these detailed, unique environments to each of these cultures and people, that's tremendous. I mean, we're making a 3D video game. They could have just taken the easy way out. They made it like the NES Zelda or Link to the Past in 3D form, but they decided to add all this music, all these dungeons, all this world building. There's a lot of reasons why this game is, Mike, thought of so highly.
Well, yeah, and I think it's just the imagery of it all, right? It's the design of it. It's so memorable. This is where we got Ganondorf, right?
Yeah, we really didn't see him before. There was a pig,
He was never a human, or he was never a humanoid. The first bunch of Zelda games, Ganon was a big blue pig. And as much as I like big blue pig Ganon, Ganondorf kind of has become like the more popular and the more prolific.
I think humanizing a villain is important. I think it makes them not necessarily relatable, but it makes them realistic, believable. The animal form is great, the monster form, but I think this was an important building part to the great villain's arc.
Well, it all just means that in the first three games, Ganon had already used the Triforce, right?
Exactly.
So this also kind of gives birth to the Zelda timeline. Because
wonderful Zelda timeline.
The Zelda timeline makes no sense. It was clearly done by Nintendo to just shut the fans up. But before we got Skyward Sword, this was the first game in the series in terms of story. And this is the bridge off. This is the bridge point, right? This is the breaking point in Nintendo's timeline for Zelda. Ocarina of Time splits the Zelda timeline into three. And we have three futures based off of this game, one of which where the adult version of the world, if he's successful, I think it's the adult version of the world if he fails, which brings us to Twilight Princess. And then there's the child version if he succeeds, because Link gets to go back at the end of this game. Spoilers, Link gets to go back and relive his childhood. So Majora's Mask is that Link, right? He takes place after that, after the child had won and moved on, after Ganon had been sealed away. But that even in and of itself is kind of crazy that they would make a game that's essentially a prequel, kind of. I mean, Link to the Past is a prequel too. Yeah. So they knew from the beginning that the A Link to the Past took place hundreds of years before the original Legend of Zelda, but this one is even older than that. So we're getting closer and closer to like the creation of Hyrule, and we kind of get the basic
George Lucas, there. This is how you do prequels.
Yeah, don't really have them connected and have them so far back.
Have them make no sense whatsoever, have no connective tissue.
That's right, like Knights of the Old Republic. So it's one of those things where we weren't really talking about a timeline at the time.
No.
But people were speculating, oh my gosh, if this is the first story, right?
But even if it didn't, Mike, these adventures were standalone enough where you could mm-hmm. just pick up and play this game, really know nothing about Zelda prior, and still have an appreciation for every item, every costume, every song. It didn't feel like you had to know what happened previously on Zelda.
No, I don't think so at all. And I think that there are a lot of people where this is their first one. Like, this is their first experience with Zelda. Like, absolutely. There's so many people that probably started here and either went back or never did and just went forward.
I wonder if you, I guess it depends on the person, what would actually be more approachable, a game like this or Link to the Past for your average gamer, but I guess it depends on the age or experience of that gamer.
I think now, I hate to say it, I think it might be a Link to the Past. I think 2D games are way more accessible for a lot of people than early 3D games that are kind of janky looking.
And there's not full descriptions always. It's not always detailing you what you should be doing next in terms of certain puzzles in this game. There's just people that have a hand-holding these days in 3D game.
Yeah. I mean, there's a little less now than there was. I mean, let's look at Skyward Sword. Skyward Sword holds your hand for like 15 hours.
I would say Twilight Princess is similar, got these really elongated tutorials. And this game has a tutorial and it is narrative driven, which I appreciate. It doesn't feel like a video game tutorial where it's like, jump over this block and push A to jump. And this game, you're learning to play the game as you're going through like the early part of the story.
Which is good. And that's probably how it should be done. But I just, I think that there are definitely things about Ocarina of Time now that haven't aged well because most N64 games haven't. Like targeting doesn't always work, or sometimes a door doesn't open when you hit the A button and you just roll with a stick, and there's stuff like that.
Also having to hit start and manage your inventory can probably be frustrating.
Yeah, a lot of menus. Yeah.
Swapping stuff out. And we did talk about how wonderful the graphics are, but that's the people like you and me who are in their late 30s. But I would say younger folks would probably find a game like this visually hard to come back to.
I think so. I think so. I mean, they were great for the time.
Yeah.
I would suggest anyone who's younger, who hasn't experienced this game, and this is even dating me because this thing's super old now too, but you're probably better off with the 3DS version.
Yeah, they did clean up. Link's model looks so much better specifically, but the textures around the world are a bit nicer.
It looks really, really good on 3DS. Like, it's actually quite cool. I would be remiss too to say that like we got other stuff, other part of the mythology too. Before this, Impa was kind of just this old lady that took care of Zelda, and we got the birth of like the ninja tribe, right? The Sheikah tribe that are essentially Legend of Zelda's ninjas. And one of the best and biggest plot twists in video games at the time was that you're guided the whole game as an adult by this like ninja looking quote unquote dude named Sheik, who kind of teaches you how to play the songs to get to the dungeons and kind of guides you through the game, and you meet them every so often, and then you find out like right before the end of the game that Sheik is Zelda.
I don't care who you are. Moment. Nobody knew that Sheik was Zelda. This was a really, I think you're undervaluing how good that plot twist was. I mean, this is like BioShock good. I mean, for 1998, we got from Nintendo games, Mario and Zelda had plot that was just so basic.
Yeah.
It's almost non-existent. You play NES Zelda, you can put together that you're fighting evil. You can put together Mario, you're saving a princess. Beyond that, there's not much. This game has a pretty intricate plot with a plot twist that's fantastic, Mike.
It's a really, really good plot twist, and it solidifies Zelda as such a unique character.
Yeah.
This was like Nintendo being like, Zelda is not a damsel.
Nope.
Right? Zelda is not a damsel in distress. She's just as powerful, and if not more so than Link, given the situation. That is continued through Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom.
She always plays a very integral part in every Zelda game, and that's why her name is in the title. She, like you said, she's as important. I love some of the epic battles I could think about, final battles where Zelda's there with you, shooting arrows or doing whatever she does best. And Sheik as well is now one of the most famous characters in Smash Brothers.
Yep.
It's a shame that we never got like a spinoff where like you get to play as Sheik in some Zelda video game, but it is great that we have the character and the birth of the character here.
Just get the sneaky armor from, from Breath of the Wild or Tears of the Kingdom. Just get the sneaky armor.
It's a Sheik video game.
Yeah, then use your Sheik.
But people said this is early, like for people that had gender and identity problems, this is representation. This is a really unique thing. And I don't know if they were being forward thinking, but people thought it was a man. You thought it was
not
I love that. Samus too. I mean, it's great where they can say, well, this character is so cool. This character is so strong, so smart, so tough. And men and women could be like, wow, I love this character. And then you find out it's a woman and you're just like, yes, that's great. It didn't have to be a man.
No. And it's even better that it's Zelda. Like, and also just be who you want to be, man.
Be who you want to be. So something else, Mike, that has been around, and we still want to honor the things that happened in the previous games, but a lot of the items, a lot of the costumes that Link uses, wears, are from previous games. You don't have just your generic green tunic. You have different colors.
Uh-huh.
You have special items that carry over from the previous games, but just as impactful, if not more so, seeing them in this game.
Yeah, I love the tunics because you actually have to change them. It's not like the other games where Link to the Past, you get the red tunic, but it's just better defense.
Yeah.
You get the upgraded sword and it's more attack. And this one, it's like, yes, you have to wear the red tunic when you're in high heat areas. You have to wear the blue tunic when you're underwater. You won't be able to breathe. And yeah, there are other items that we saw in other games, but they work so much better in 3D. The bow and arrow is incredible in 3D. The slingshot's amazing in 3D. The boomerang is so good in 3D. The hookshot, like all these things just were upgraded to 3D. And some of the new items are just so cool. Like the iron boots, I think, are such a cool item. They would eventually really see incredible use in Twilight Princess, where because they're made out of iron, you can be magnetized.
Magic. You feel like Spider-Man. You really did the first time you did that. But there was something magical about each of those items you talked about. But I think what was unique, Mike, was the transition from third-person view to first-person view when you used a lot of those items.
Yeah, I think that was it. And being able to use them, whether you're Z-targeting and you're in third-person or you just kind of free-aim in first, I think that was just such a unique and interesting thing that we would really learn to appreciate in Zelda moving forward.
Totally. So, Mike, we talked about storyline, which this game has a great story. We talked about exploration and the open fields of Hyrule and different things there and the different areas. We talked about the unique environments that you travel through in this game. But the next thing I want to talk about is some of the dungeons, because we had dungeons in The Legend of Zelda on the Nintendo. We had dungeons in A Link to the Past, but again, it just feels different in Ocarina of Time. What did you feel specifically about the dungeons in this game?
I think all the dungeons in this game are unique and original and deliver something that nothing else delivered at that point in time. The ability to operate in three dimensions is so much better for the dungeons than two dimensions. When you're in the Dundongo's cavern at the beginning and the second dungeon of the game, you have to drop the bombs from like a perch down a level into the eyes of the Dundongo statue so that you can move forward. I mean, that's incredible.
And you do the same thing with the Deku Tree when you drop the torch down.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a sense of, you said it earlier, scale, that you can't get in a 2D game. And in 3D, when you see these large spaces that you're traversing in, it's impressive. And we've seen fire temples and water temples now dozens of times, it feels like, but this was the first time experiencing it in that environment.
And the rooms are incredible. Like the fact that when in one of the temples, you got to use a special seeing magnifying glass to like see things that are attacking you. The boss fights that you would fight at the end are incredibly inventive, and every single one's different. Whether it's Goma, you have to shoot in the face while it's on the ceiling, or King Dondongo that you have to trick into inhaling a giant bomb, or you're fighting the guy with the hands on the bongos. I think his name is Bongo Bongo. I think that's the Shadow Temple, the two witches. The giant amoeba thing isn't great. You just hookshot that thing. And the Water Temple is just tedious. If anything, it's tedious.
Yeah, I'm going to try and be nice, but that is not what I would say necessarily a fun experience, but you feel accomplished at least when you beat it.
Yeah, I mean, I heard it argued that, well, it's a dungeon that forces you to think, but at the same time,
It's tedious. The amount of up raising and lowering, and I think newer Zelda games did Water Temples better than this.
Yeah.
But you still can, first time around playing it, the amazement of controlling water and doing this, it is kind of impressive.
Oh, it's very impressive. It's just annoying after a while that you missed one small key. So now you have to figure out how to get the water drained all the way back to where you lost it. And then you have to do step by step back the other way. So it's frustrating. But I'm not going to hate on the Water Temple much more than that. I do have to say, though, I do enjoy that one of the dungeons is you're just inside of a giant fish.
Inside Jabba's belly. Yeah, that is, it's a very unique, I'd say it's one of the most memorable. Because you truly feel from the colors and the textures like you're inside a monster or fish's belly.
Yeah, it's like Pinocchio, right?
Yeah.
It's like you're inside the whale's stomach and you have to walk around with the Zora princess.
Yep.
I think Princess Ruto.
And you're like carrying her around.
And you have to carry her around. And when you leave her in one spot and go and fight something in the room, you come out and she's mad at you. That's pretty funny. And then that boss is cool too. He's like a giant jellyfish you got to hit with the boomerang. So yeah, this game, just all of the boss fights, all of the dungeons are just so unique and original. So everything's unique. Original. Feels so original about this
right
game.
From the Deku Tree all the way down to the Shadow Temple, the Spirit Temple. These were really special, unique firsts. And you talked about some of the enemies and bosses that are impressive in this game. Transferring them to a 3D space, the villains, some of you said the giant spider, but even some of the enemies out in the world, they feel very Zelda, what we know today. The bats, which are the Keese, the Like-Likes, the Mad Scrubs, the Stalfos. These are things that existed in Zelda and still exist in Zelda, and they just felt like they belong in the world. These are things that just felt very Zelda, but they were quote-unquote original at the time in a 3D space.
Yeah, I mean, there are even moblins, right? The big moblins are in there.
You're right.
The Octoroks are in there. They definitely got the upgrade. They definitely got the 3D upgrade, and it was pretty impressive. We would not get the Bobakins yet. Those would come a little later. I believe those didn't show up till Wind Waker, and now they're like a mainstay.
They're like Goombas. They're like the fodder that you fight all the time.
Yeah. They're exactly.
But you did
like
get Lizalvos in this game, which I think are wonderful. I love those lizard looking.
Those fights are cool too, where you have to like trick them into hitting the shield so that you can. And those are cinematic fights where they'll hop at you and you have to block them. It's really cool.
It is strategic. Like you said, the Gerudo guards,
the
Gerudo thieves are really cool. I mean, they're Gerudos like we know them today. What are the name of those creepy looking things that scream in your face, Mike?
Oh, the Rededs?
They're not the Gibdos, right?
The Gibdos are the mummies.
Right.
The other ones, they pretty much do the same. The Rededs. They pretty much do the same thing.
They freeze you in your spot, correct?
Yeah, that was terrifying. That's still scary.
Horrifying.
But if you play the Sun Song, it freezes them.
And a lot of these characters and enemies have returned in Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, and they've gotten some modifications to them. But those Tears of the Kingdom characters that kind of slowly come towards you and then they start going across the floor really fast.
Yeah.
In the Gerudo, I think that's kind of like a Redead. Isn't that kind of
the Gibdos?
They're Gibdos. Okay.
Yeah, they're Gibdos. And those are awesome. I loved all of that stuff. You had to hit them with the electricity.
With the electricity, so cool. You hit them with the arrows.
That's so cool. That boss was really tough.
Really tough boss. But I feel like that kind of stems from Ocarina. I feel like it all comes back to this.
Gibdos were in the game previously, the mummies, but they completely changed what they were like in Ocarina, and then they've pretty much run with Gibdos as like that since then.
Gotcha. But the bosses, you named it, Queen Goma, the Dongos haven't existed since the original.
Yeah.
The different Ganons, Phantom Ganon, there was just so much good here as far as boss fights.
Oh, Phantom Ganon's awesome. The Zelda baseball is the best.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with Zelda baseball, really.
No, you can't.
It was really well done. And there's a reason why this game, Mike, and no drum roll needed here, 99 on Metacritic. It's the only game to beat Tony Hawk's Pro Skater.
THPS, baby. Tony Hawk 2.
Ocarina of Time just is barely better than Tony Hawk. No, Mike, this game will never be beaten on Metacritic. And there's a couple reasons why. One is, this is before Metacritic actually existed. So when Metacritic first popped up, they took whatever 19, 20 reviews there were and populated this Metacritic score. But now there's hundreds of reviews for a game to make a Metacritic score. Back then, I think there were 17 or 18 originally. And IGN, GameSpot, a bunch of these places gave their only 10 they'd ever given at that time. And it was a monumental thing.
Yeah.
But today, even games like Breath of the Wild that had a 98 or 99, some guy decided to give it a 7 out of 10, and that drops it down to a 96 or 97. So it's nearly impossible in this day and age to get anything as high as a 99.
Those people are stupid. I mean,
well, they get death threats, those people that give 7 out of 10. So
Tears of the Kingdom is better than Ocarina.
Like, oh, absolutely.
It's way better. And that's saying a lot, because Ocarina is like incredibly good. But
Ocarina of Time is a of grand proportion, one of the greatest games ever made. But yes, the games have done better now.
We've
had 25 years.
The games are better now. Like, but that being said, Ocarina of Time is a game that is at the top of many people's lists and has every right to be there. It's a special experience. It's an original experience. Nothing else at the time felt like it. And you know what? Outside of Zelda games, not much else feels like it since.
Unfortunately, though, you and me, every time a new Zelda comes out, this one goes further and further down our personal favorite and best 3D Zelda games. And
I'm going to push back just a little.
You don't put Wind Waker above this in your personal?
Wind Waker I would put above this.
Do you put Breath of the Wild or Tears of the Kingdom above this?
Yeah, but there are two games you didn't say.
I know that. But still, every time a new Zelda game comes out, it seems like we're pushing it further down. And
it is. It does. But I mean,
there are people out there that think Twilight Princess and Skyward Sword are better than this. And I don't think they're necessarily wrong. It becomes opinion. Those are both, like we said, they're pizza.
Hey man,
pizza's good in any form.
Pizza is great in any form. I'll tell you that right now. I don't even mind it if somebody accidentally might put a piece of pineapple on it. I would never order it.
Pizza bagels are good. Pizza rolls are good.
I like a French bread pizza, you know. They've changed that now. It's no longer like if you cut Italian bread down the middle and make it into a pizza, it's no longer like a French bread or Italian pizza. Now it's flatbread. It's like, all right, dude, I know what you did.
Pizza in some guy's backyard in a pizza machine in a pizza oven is still good pizza.
I have a pizza oven, Matt, and I'll tell you, I make a pretty good pizza.
There you go. So that's Zelda, Mike. You can say what you want, throw your shade at Twilight Princess and Skyward Sword, which have gotten excellent HD remasters, but this game was fourth best selling game on the N64. It sold 7.6 million copies on a system that was not generally all that successful.
No, definitely not. And I would say the N64 probably sold maybe 30 million?
I was thinking 30. It was the number in my mind. It
30,
might be
to 30 to 50 million. And that's a huge attach rate.
One out of three, one out of four, maybe.
Yeah. That's really, really good. I would imagine the games that sold better than this were like Mario Kart, Mario 64, and GoldenEye, maybe. So
Mario 64, Mario Kart, GoldenEye, in that order.
Yeah.
12 million, 10 million, 8 million to down to this is 7.6. And Smash Brothers becomes a huge leap lower, another 2 million units less.
Wow, crazy.
So Zelda had the fourth spot pretty safely. It's kind of shocking that GoldenEye, which was a James Bond movie, outsold Zelda. But that game was a phenomenon. We've talked about that.
Yeah, no, GoldenEye was like, it was like the party game for a very long time. What's crazy is that we look at Ocarina of Time and be like, yeah, that's one of the best-selling games of the N64. It sold 7 million copies. And then you're like, oh, wait. Like,
the worst game on the Switch sells that now by Nintendo.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that Tears of the Kingdom and Breath of the Wild will both have sold well over 30 million copies before their time is done. So it's crazy to see how much the scale has continued. This game is pretty accessible. You can play it in a lot of places. I would highly suggest playing the 3DS remaster if you can. But yes, I understand that the emulation for the N64 on Switch isn't great, but it's a place you can play this game.
You know, what's a shame is the 3DS version of Mario 64 was a good remaster. Is that the DS? There's a DS version.
DS, regular DS.
The Mario 64 DS version is a very good, besides some control issues, it got some updated graphics, and that game got an eShop release. But unfortunately, the Majora's Mask and Ocarina of Time games for the 3DS never got any port at all. They're locked on those systems, Mike.
I wonder if that'll change. I wonder if that'll change moving forward.
I would love it. Even if you take the 3D out, is there a way to make those games accessible on different consoles?
I think so.
We have the 25th anniversary. We're a couple months away from it. It'd be nice. They don't always pay homage to these type of things.
They seem to not pay homage to any anniversaries anymore. I mean, Donkey Kong came and went.
A bunch of them came and went. We really got Mario and Luigi, and we had the year Luigi, and really since then, they've kind of ignored the Kirby, the Donkey Kong, and everyone else that deserved proper recognition.
I mean, there was the buy everything before March 31st.
Right. So I'm going to do my own little show and tell, because Mike often likes to bring his analog pocket out. He likes to show all of his awesome equipment that he's collecting over the years. So I'm going to show off here. There's a visual.
There he goes. Item. There he goes.
We have Ocarina of Time sealed, graded, and it is absolutely gorgeous. And this is,
look at that. Wow.
It is a game that I can still play on the Switch, but look at in Nintendo 64 sealed.
That's
cartridge.
The way to do it. That's the way to do it. You can look at it in your graded case. 9.4 is pretty good.
It's not a bad score whatsoever. So I know people have said things, the Switch Online version had some fog and issues with emulation. I get that. I still think it's a perfectly accessible. They have made some fixes. If that's how you need to play it, still experience this game.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's incredibly important. I think it's a really great piece of history.
So, Mike, we finally did this game right. We did our first remastered episode, Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time for the Nintendo 64. Did you have any closing statements?
I pretty much said everything I wanted to say about this game. I would highly suggest everyone play it. If there's any way, shape, or form you can get your hands on the Master Quest version, give that a try too.
That's on the GameCube specifically?
It was originally on the N64 DD,
right?
But that never came to America. So there was a GameCube disc that was given out at GameStop as a pre-order bonus for Wind Waker when Wind Waker got pushed back. And you could play Ocarina of Time and the Master Quest on the GameCube, which was cool. But that disc probably goes for a lot of money now. So,
yeah, the Ocarina of Time / Master Quest combo, 2-game bonus disc. GameCube, I feel like, gave a lot of love to Zelda. You got the Four Swords Adventures. We got Wind Waker.
Uh-huh.
We got a copy of Twilight Princess also on the Wii.
Yeah.
But I feel like GameCube, and they got that promotional disc of the Collector's Edition, if you remember.
Yeah, which had
the four games. So I feel like GameCube did a good job loving Zelda.
GameCube was probably, before Switch, probably the best console to play Zelda on.
You're right. But I agree. That is an awesome, the Master Quest version for pros out there.
Yeah, it's really good.
It is really good. So good recommendation there from Mike. Mike, do you want to, we haven't done this in a while, anything you've been playing these last few weeks that you want to kind of shout out?
Yeah, I've been playing Final Fantasy 16 a lot, and I'm still finishing up Tears of the Kingdom. Yeah, Tears of the Kingdom is like the game that never ends. Even though I'm getting close to the end, it still feels like there's so much to do. But I love it. I've talked a lot about Tears of the Kingdom on this podcast. Final Fantasy 16, I actually really, really enjoy quite a bit. I know Matt's been itching to know like where I would put this when I rank my Final Fantasy games. I think I'm going to soon give you some sort of tier listing.
Mike, what you'll need to do is you'll have to sit by the beach or by a pool, get yourself a nice polar seltzer, nice and cold. Sit down with, not with your phone, take a notepad and a pencil because you want to maybe erase and cross things out.
Yeah, why not?
And really think about it. I don't want to pressure you to make this list before you're ready.
Yeah, I know, but you're dying.
I'm dying. You know, I want to know, does this game really reach the heights of Final Fantasy VI, Final Fantasy VII, Final Fantasy VII Remake? Does it reach that top tier? Would it be in a middle tier with some of like the secondary best games like Final Fantasy? Well, Nine, I left out of that. You love Nine as well. Or does it sit somewhere in the middle?
If I was to do a tier list of Final Fantasies, this would not be in the S tier. I think it would be more towards the middle. I really like it.
B tier Final Fantasy is a really good video game.
Yeah, very, very good. I mean, my A tier, without talking about anything else, my A tier is probably like, you know, 12. Final Fantasy is like 4, 5, and 10. Like, that's my A tier. 12 is one that I love. So 12, I'm going to inflate. It's how I feel about that game. It might be an A, it might be an S. 12 is a game I sank so much time into, and I absolutely loved everything about it. But I know it's divisive. But my A tier is like 4, 5, and 10, which are three fantastic games. So yeah, I mean, obviously, just by hearing that, you know what my S tier is. Like,
right.
You know, I'm not even trying to hide what's in that S tier. But as of right now, Final Fantasy 16 is kind of in the middle of the pack. I think it's not nearly.
Have you seen enough gameplay, story-wise, world-building-wise, to fully know what this game is? I know there's a big plot point people talk about. Have you gotten to whatever that key moment is?
I've gotten to a lot of stuff, and I've gone through a lot of stuff, and I've done a lot of the crazy boss fights, and I'm probably a little bit more than halfway through the game. So I think in the next week or so, I'll probably have a better idea of that.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. I mean, it's a big game from what I've heard, and visually it is spectacular.
It is. Visually, yeah, it's incredible. I mean, it's like nothing else quite looks like this at that point in time.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's pretty great.
Oh, that's cool, Mike.
So yeah, I'm enjoying it. And once that's done, and Tears of the Kingdom is done, I can finally like give Pikmin 4.
I know. I feel bad for Pikmin 4 because it came out a couple weeks ago now. And the shame of it is, first, I was knee deep in Tears of the Kingdom. I finally teached our boy Ganon a lesson. Good. And finished that game. And that game is, I think it's crazy that I'm about to say this. I think it's the greatest game ever made. And I don't say those things like most of my favorite games are games I played when I'm like 5, 10, 15 years old.
Breath of the
Wild, like barely scratched my top 10 or 15 because I thought it was great and innovative, but never did it. This game was legendary. And then I followed it up with Jedi Survivor, a game that I heard was not equally as great, but I heard wonderful things about. And it left me kind of sour. And I don't know if that's coming off of Zelda. I don't think so. I think I'm mature enough of a gamer that I can judge it on its own. And
a little bit of that sequelitis, huh?
I think that's what it is. I think coming off of Jedi Fallen Order was a game that I was pretty high on. It was new and fresh.
Yeah.
This game's not new and fresh enough. It adds like a dash. It adds like a couple different stances with the lightsaber and then expects you to play the same 20-hour adventure besides a couple of minor tweaks.
Yeah, it's hard.
The story has a couple of beats, but I'm pretty sour on it. So I know a lot of people are putting it in their top 5, top 10s ready for this year. If I play 10 other games, I think I'm going to probably put them ahead of it.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. I pretty much, my top 5 is pretty much solid right now for 2023.
I still have Pikmin 4, as you stated, to play. Yeah. I still have Hogwarts Legacy to play.
Yeah.
And there's countless other games that came out this year we talked about in our recap of 2023 already. Not to mention the great games coming out in the future.
Yeah, I mean, Spider-Man alone, right?
That has to be on everyone's top 5 list when it comes out. I can't imagine Insomniac, which they've been hitting game after game. They're not going to release a slouch.
I think Insomniac is Sony's best developer. I think Naughty Dog gets all the credit, but I think Insomniac does much better work.
I totally agree with you. So that's what I've been playing lately. I'm going to start something new now that I completed those two games, and I will share in weeks to come what that ends up being.
Beautiful.
So, Mike, we are finished July, where as this releases in early August. Tell me what you can promote, what you're up to, and where can we find you?
So you can find me here on the Hall of Fame Video Game Podcast. Also, you can find me at my other podcast, Batmantasticast, where we talk about Batman. You can find me at my band, Bad Mary. We got a big show at the Amityville Music Hall on September 3rd, which is the Sunday before Labor Day. That's a huge, huge show. Please find us at badmary.com or at Bad Mary Band on all the social media platforms. You can buy tickets for that show. It's one of those shows where we want to kind of show off and have a big crowd. So if you can come out to that, if you're into that type of stuff, that'd be awesome. And then most importantly, probably by the time this airs, probably next week, we are doing the Long Island Retro Gaming Expo at the Cradle of Aviation Museum from August 11th through the 13th, 2023. It is one of the best weekends of the year. It is an incredible thing to come to. It is an amazing event. It is a family-friendly, fun, gamers of all walks of life type of event. You can come and play Sonic 2. You can come and play a Japanese import computer from 1992. It's a wild experience. And if you're into gaming at all, or you have friends that are into gaming, just come. Have a great time.
Yeah, it's amazing the diversity and variety of different stuff I see there that every time I turn my head, I get whiplash because of all the different games that just, when it comes to just old PC games, it's console games, it's arcade games, it's everything and anything. And I'm just so impressed by the care put in by everyone there to get that feeling back. Yeah. And it's special.
And this year, if you have a 3DS, bring it, because I think Street Pass is going to be happening. Also, if you have old Pokemon cartridges and games, bring them, because we have established a full-blown Poke Lab that will have our Pokemon professor in it giving out old event Pokemon that have been given out by Nintendo since like 1998. So if you have a red or blue, you can bring it. You can get old event Pokemon. If you have Diamond or Pearl, you can bring it. You can get old event Pokemon that you can't really get anymore. We'll have cosplayers, we'll have photos. I was kind of like my brainchild, so I'm very proud of that. So yeah, you got to come. It's going to be a great time.
Yeah. And last year it was a jam-packed, exciting event. And I imagine each year, and it's grown, and I can't wait. As this records, as Mike said, it'll be the following week. So
yeah,
that's exciting. Please do, guys, check out our back catalog as this first remaster comes out. We have 135 plus previous episodes, which is a tremendous number, but we're very proud of the games in this Hall of Fame, and we have plenty more to come, and about a dozen or so remasters that deserve a little more conversation. So this we're going to do again, Mike.
I agree. Let's do it.
So that's it, guys. Enjoy. Continue to enjoy your summer, and we'll see you guys all next time.
Later.
From Mike and Matt, thank you for listening to the Hall of Fame Game Podcast. Check us out on Instagram at Hall of Fame Pod or email us at thehalloffamepod@gmail.com. Please leave us a review and be sure to tune in next time.